Welcome to episode 23 of Theatre Audience Podcast. I'm Natalie, and in the absence of live theatre, I'll be bringing you the news, reviews, interviews, and recommendations of the latest must-see theatre online. In episodes 21 and 22 of Theatre Audience Podcast, and on my Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts, I've been discussing what's on, what's been and gone, and the best theatrical entertainment online during the lockdown. So it's been a difficult month for everyone. I really want my podcast now to be a space for creativity where actors can share their experiences, expertise, and skills with my drama students and my audience. As a graduate from Warwick University in theatre and performance arts, I specialised in Shakespeare and his contemporaries. As a previous actress and head of drama in a secondary school for 18 years, I want to put these podcasts out to my students, my regular listeners, and drama teachers across the country. I want this podcast to be bursting full of positivity, and to that end, I've created a Teaching Theatre in Quarantine series. I'm taking work from the page to the stage. So welcome to my Trapped Teaching Tempest podcast series. I've joined forces with a range of experienced actors from the Royal Shakespeare Company, the National Theatre, and the West End. And they are lending me their voices and skills and expertise in delivering for us some monologues and duologues from The Tempest. We will be looking at how an actor prepares for these speeches, both mentally, physically, and vocally. So here's some context. William Shakespeare was born 23rd of April 1564. The Tempest had its first ever performance on the 1st of November 1611 and was first printed posthumously as the opening play in William Shakespeare's First Folio Collected Works of 1623. However, in the chronology of the plays that Shakespeare wrote, The Tempest was one of his last. So between 1610 and 1613, he wrote The Winter's Tale, The Tempest, and finally, Henry VIII. It is reported that he also died on the 23rd of April, but this was in 1616. The Tempest has long dazzled audiences with its intricate blend of magic, music, humour, intrigue, and tenderness. It charmed Jacobean audiences, played to packed houses from the Restoration Theatre through to the 18th century. It then emerged as a focal point in the 19th century in European debates about the nature of humanity. And in the 21st century, it is used in writings on Western imperialism and its demise. The Tempest has been a play for all eras, all continents, and many ideologies. And although other Shakespearean plays enjoy worldwide recognition, in the aftermath of the British Empire, The Tempest has been uniquely adapted by formerly colonised nations in refreshing their post-colonial identities. The most striking examples of such an approach were Jonathan Miller's production at the Mermaid Theatre in 1970 and at the Old Vic in 1988, where the play emerged as a parable for colonialisation. Rudolf Walker's enslaved black Caliban exchanged the white master Prospero for the black master Ariel, who at the end of the play reassembled Prospero's discarded staff and held it threateningly over Caliban and his fellow islanders. In The Tempest, long considered one of Shakespeare's most lyrical plays, Prospero, a magician on an enchanted island, punishes his enemies, brings happiness to his daughter, and comes to terms with the human use of supernatural power. The Tempest embodies both seemingly timeless romance and the historically specific moment in which Europe begins to explore and conquer the New World. Shakespeare wrote three main kinds of play: tragedies, comedies, and histories. The Tempest is a comedy, but that doesn't mean the whole thing is meant to be funny. Much of it is fairly light-hearted, though, and all Shakespeare's comedies have a happy ending. Most of the funny bits are the scenes with Stefano, Trinculo, and Caliban. They spend most of their time being drunk and coming up with silly schemes. These scenes might not seem side-splitting to you or me, but Shakespeare's audience would have been roaring with laughter. The Tempest is the most lyrical, profound, and fascinating of Shakespeare's late comedies, and Prospero, long exiled from Italy with his daughter Miranda, seeks to use his magical powers to defeat his former enemies. Eventually, having proved merciful, he divests himself of that magic, his art, and prepares to return to the mainland. The Tempest has often been regarded as Shakespeare's farewell to the stage before his retirement. Its complexity of thought, its range of characters from the spirit Ariel and the monster Caliban to the beautiful Miranda and her prince Ferdinand, its poetic beauty and its exploration of difficult questions that still haunt us today make this play wonderfully compelling. In the past, critics emphasised the romantically beautiful features of The Tempest. They saw it as an imaginative fantasia. In recent decades, however, The Tempest has been treated as a potentially political drama, which offers controversial insights into colonialism and racism. Frequently staged and diversely filmed, this play has influenced numerous poets and novelists and the musical Return to the Forbidden Planet. So what's The Tempest all about? Well, in this powerful dreamlike play, Shakespeare seems to channel all that has worked in his earlier dramas into a single magical piece of theatre. Many consider The Tempest his greatest achievement. Now, I've recently read Henry V, and like Henry V, another man who confronts representatives of a corrupt, complicated human society, Prospero is completely successful in his efforts to transcend and remake that society. I mean, on the surface, these two men couldn't be more different. Henry grows into a pragmatic, vigorous politician warrior, and Prospero has become a wise and tested sorcerer. Yet, each man knows the limits of human nature and authority, including his own, and each man has mental resolve strong enough to resolve past wrongs and bring about a new kind of society, seemingly by force. Prospero is the last and greatest of Shakespeare's protagonists to serve as an onstage dramatist, controlling and directing the events around him. He seems to be not only the hero of this play, but somehow of all the previous plays as well. In The Tempest, the foiled plots and conspiracies of evil people, the final triumph of both innocence and age, the banishment of animal selfishness, all these seem parts of a far larger story than the play that we're actually watching. They seem relevant to the great impertinent human drama that we all create day by day. So to that end, there are several themes in The Tempest that are worth looking out for. Fate and justice, magic, love, freedom, betrayal and forgiveness, slavery and service. And now onto the plot summary. If you know the storyline already, then feel free to skip this bit. So what happens? A terrible storm besieges a ship that carries King Alonso of Naples and members of his party. Thanks to the magical intervention of Prospero, who initiated the storm, the ship wrecks on a strange island. No loss of life, although the passengers are separated. We learn that Prospero, the Duke of Milan, years before was wrongly deprived of his throne by Antonio, his brother, acting in league with the king. Prospero was abandoned at sea with his young daughter Miranda. Eventually, the two came ashore upon the magical island, which had previously served as a banishing place for the witch Sycorax. For 12 years, Prospero and Miranda have lived here. Prospero's proficiency in magic allowed him to set free spirits, including Ariel, his servant, and the enslaved monster Caliban, Sycorax's son, who fell into disfavor with Prospero when he attempted to rape Miranda. The virtuous Gonzalo tries to comfort the king, who believes his son Ferdinand has perished in the shipwreck. The two fall asleep when Ariel casts a spell on them. Antonio and Sebastian, Alonso's brother, plot to kill the king. Ariel awakens the sleeping pair. Caliban encounters the fool, Trinculo, and the drunken butler, Stefano. They give him wine, and he vows to worship them as gods. Ferdinand, set to work by Prospero, falls in love with Miranda. Caliban, Trinculo, and Stefano drunkenly discuss a plot to kill Prospero, steal his books, and take over the island. A banquet appears and disappears. Ariel, in the form of a harpy, warns the hungry king and his companions that Ferdinand's loss is retribution for past sins. Alonso leaves, hoping to find his son's body and die where it lies. Prospero agrees to the engagement of Ferdinand to his daughter and tells Ariel to provide celebratory entertainment. The subsequent masque is interrupted when Prospero remembers the plot against his life by Caliban and his companions. He tricks them and sets spirits disguised as dogs after them. Prospero sends Ariel to collect the shaken king Antonio, Sebastian, and Gonzalo. He promises to show mercy to his past tormentors and, once his business is done, to abandon magic forever. His enemies reconcile themselves to Prospero and restore his dukedom. Alonso is reunited with his son Ferdinand. We learn that the ship has been restored to working order by the bosun. Prospero orders Ariel to supply favourable weather for the trip back to Milan, and then sets his spirit free. So what have I done? Well, actors have recorded speeches for me and then created a commentary of how they prepared that monologue as actors. I've been creative with the GCSE and A-level drama questions that I've set them. If you've got a copy of the play, we're going to start with Act 1. So imagine that we've had the huge tempest, this storm that has been raging at sea and on board the ship. We then turn to Act 1, Scene 2. In this scene, Miranda begs her father Prospero to calm this tempest. She feels the suffering of the shipwrecked people and is full of pity for them. After her speech, Prospero assures her that no harm has been done. So here's Act 1, Scene 2, the opening speech of Miranda to her father Prospero on the island.
If by your art, my dearest father, you have put the wild waters in this roar, allay them. The sky, it seems, would pour down stinking pitch, but that the sea, mounting to the welkin's cheek, dashes the fire out. Oh, I have suffered with those that I saw suffer. A brave vessel who had no doubt some noble creature in her dashed all to pieces. Oh, the cry did knock against my very heart. Poor souls, they perished. Had I been any god of power, I would have sunk the sea within the earth, or ere it should the good ship so have swallowed and the frauding souls within her.
So thank you to Jess Kambitsis for her rendition of Miranda in Act 1, Scene 2. Jess is a recent graduate from Rose Bruford College of Theatre and Performance and is a former drama student of mine and played a brilliant Veruca Salt when she was in Year 8. Here's her explanation of how she prepared this speech.
So in terms of vocally preparing for this speech, I think it's a really wordy speech and there's a lot of imagery in it. So I think it's about really warming up your articulators, so doing lots of exercises that kind of stretch your tongue and massaging your lips and all of that kind of stuff so that you can really wrap your mouth around the words. Because I really struggled at first to make sense of it and make all the words come out properly. So yeah, I'd do that. I'd also just, I think about what Miranda's just seen, and what she's been through, and why she's having to go to her dad to say this, because it's quite a bold move to go to her dad and say all of this. So she's clearly desperate, and she's clearly seen something that has really shaken her. So I'd think about the emotional preparation for that, because then that will also feed into the vocal preparation that you do as well. And just to add to what I just said, I was just rereading it, and I think it's really interesting that she uses the word O twice. I've been taught quite a lot that an O can hold so much. Like, it has so much emotion in it. It can have so many feelings in it. It can say a million words in just one little letter. And the fact that she uses that twice in one speech, I think, is really telling. And it tells us that she's emotional and that she's seen a lot. So I think I'd also just look for clues in the text like that.
Prospero decides to tell Miranda her life story. He again assures her that no one was hurt in the shipwreck, not an hair perished. He questions her about what she remembers, then reveals that he was once the Duke of Milan. Prospero says that he found comfort and strength in Miranda's smile as a child growing up, in divine providence and in Gonzalo's help. He believes that fortune now favours him, as his enemies are within his reach. He causes Miranda to fall asleep. Prospero calls Ariel, who reports that he has carried out Prospero's commands in exact detail. Ariel's miraculous display of fire caused terror on the ship. And now we pick up from Act 1, Scene 2, line 189, with Ariel's speech.
All hail, great master! Grave sir, hail! I come to answer thy best pleasure, be it to fly, to swim, to dive into the fire, to ride on the curled clouds, to thy strong bidding task, Ariel and all his quality. To every article. I boarded the king's ship. Now on the beak, now in the waist, the deck, in every cabin I flamed amazement. Sometime I'll divide and burn in many places. On the topmast, the yards, and bowsprit would I flame distinctly, then meet and join. Jove's lightnings, the precursors, oh, the dreadful thunderclaps, more momentary and sight outrunning, were not. The fire and cracks of sulphurous roaring, the most mighty Neptune seemed to besiege, and make his bold waves tremble. Yea, his dread trident shake! Not a soul but felt a fever of the mad, and played some tricks of desperation. All but mariners plunged in the foaming brine and quit the vessel, then all afire with me. The king's son, Ferdinand, with hair upstaring, then like reeds, not hair, was the first man that leapt, cried, "Hell is empty, and all the devils are here!"
Thank you to Tom Dickerson for his interpretation of Ariel. Tom is a recent graduate from Arts Ed Drama School, and he was recently performing on tour in Book of Mormon. He's also a former A-level drama student of mine, and we did a full interview back in episode 5 of Theatre Audience Podcast. So Ariel owes his freedom to Prospero. A witch called Sycorax imprisoned Ariel in a tree on the island for 12 years. Prospero freed Ariel with his magic. Ariel then became Prospero's servant. Ariel is keen to do what Prospero commands so that he can earn his freedom. And he keeps pointing out what a good job he's doing. He doesn't want Prospero to forget his promise to let him go. So in today's theatre, Ariel could be played by either a male or female actress. And Ariel assists Prospero in seeking retribution over his enemies. He has a magical and ethereal feel. Here's Tom's explanation of how he created his character.
So when preparing for a Shakespeare role, in this case Ariel, first, of course, I'd read through the Shakespeare play, and then I'd try and find a copy of it online, perhaps, and then I'd read through the spark notes of you know, what Shakespeare means in our today language, and the Tempest version of that. And in terms of vocally, because he's a spirit, and because he's one that's pining for the release from his master, Prospero, I think you have to consider that spirits were seen as mischievous and mysterious, and when matched with the motive to impress Prospero in this situation, their temperament should be seductive and smooth, you know, so the word should be coloured and enjoyed when spoken, to try and inspire the listener, along with an excited and unpredictable rhythm, all joined together with, you know, a lucid and ghost-like tone.
In the rest of Act 1, Scene 2, Prospero takes charge. He gets very angry with Ariel. Then Caliban argues with Prospero. Then there's time for a bit of romance to cheer us up. Ferdinand and Miranda meet for the first time and fall in love. Ariel brings Ferdinand to Prospero and Miranda by singing to them. Ferdinand thinks his father Alonso and the other people who were on the ship are dead, and Ferdinand and Miranda instantly fall in love, and Prospero is pleased. But Prospero decides to make things a little bit difficult for them. Then we proceed into Act 2, Scene 1, where we meet some of the survivors from the ship. It doesn't take long for Antonio and Sebastian to start plotting some nasty deeds. Sebastian and Antonio are up to no good. The survivors discuss what's happened. Alonso is very upset. And then, as if there aren't enough plots to get your head around, Antonio and Sebastian now get in on the act. Antonio persuades Sebastian to kill Alonso, and Ariel then wakes Gonzalo up just in time to uncover what might have been. So this moves us on to Act 2, Scene 2, where Caliban curses Prospero, saying that his creatures control and torment him for the slightest offence. Caliban was born on the island. His mother was Sycorax the witch. He's bitter and bad-tempered. He says the island is his and Prospero has stolen it from him. He curses a lot, although in an entertaining kind of way. Prospero sees Caliban as a savage animal and treats him as a slave. Even the sweet-hearted Miranda can't stand him. He's an ugly, earthy monster, and he's very different to our ethereal Ariel, who is light and airy and magical. Caliban is described in the folio edition of The Tempest as a salvage and deformed slave. The word salvage is an earlier form of the modern savage, but in Shakespeare's day it meant wild and uncivilized, rather than cruel or bestial. Caliban's deformity is never exactly specified. He is insultingly referred to as a tortoise, as a fish, and as a beast. And in the final act, Prospero describes him as this misshapen knave, and as one who is as disproportioned in his manners as in his shape. Later on, Trinculo says that he has a very ancient and fish-like smell. So here is the character Caliban. He enters with a burden of wood, and a noise of thunder is heard.
All the infections that the sun sucks up from bogs, fens, flats on Prosper fall and make him by inchmeal a disease. His spirits hear me, and yet I needs must curse. But they'll nor pinch, fright me with urchin shows, pitch me in the mire, nor lead me like a firebrand in the dark out of my way, unless he bid them. but for every trifle are they set upon me. Sometime like apes that mow and chatter at me, and after bite me, then like hedgehogs which lie tumbling in my barefoot way, and mount their pricks at my footfall. Sometime am I all wound with adders who with cloven tongues do hiss me into madness. Lo, now, lo, here comes a spirit of his, and to torment me for bringing wood in slowly. I'll fall flat. Perchance he will not mind me.
Thank you to Mark Holden for his interpretation of Caliban. Mark was recently playing the role of James Morse in Pretty Woman in the West End at the Piccadilly Theatre. He's an incredibly experienced actor, and you can listen to our interview in full in episode 21 of Theatre Audience Podcast. In this soliloquy, Caliban is alone on stage speaking his thoughts aloud for the audience. Here's the other half of our interview, where Mark discusses how, as an actor, he has prepared for this role. So you looked at Act 2, Scene 2 for me, for my Tempest podcast. And so talk to me about, have you played the role of Caliban before?
No, I haven't played the role of Caliban. I mean, I've read all of Shakespeare's plays. I set myself that task many, many years ago. So I remember that play very well because of Caliban. He's one of the colourful characters from from that actual play. So,
yeah.
And I chose that particular monologue because the words in it are just colourful, you know, with adjectives. Just explains to the iota of how he's feeling, what he's feeling towards, you know, Prosper. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you should say that because I set myself that task years and years ago, back when I was at university, to read all of Shakespeare's, and I managed to do all of them but six. So I have actually set myself that task for this period of time.
Some of them are quite dry to get through. So, yeah. Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Some I'm going to listen to on audio tape because there's quite a lot of nice recordings out there, which is fantastic. So this Caliban character, in that speech, So my students, they're asked in their sort of GCSE and A-level exams to think, as an actor, you've been asked to perform the role of Caliban in a production of The Tempest. And then they're asked, like, in your answer, explain how you'd communicate your character to the audience, thinking about your vocal skills. So as an actor, when you looked at that monologue for me, what were you thinking with regards to your vocal skills?
Well, first of all, it doesn't matter if it's a Shakespeare monologue or any monologue or piece of writing that you're going to be doing, is that you have to understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to understand all the words in there and how they're, in what context they're being said, who they're being said to, and what they actually mean. If you don't know what you're talking about, you can't convey that to the audience or the person listening. So for me, what I did is read it very carefully, you know, looked at all the words, understood exactly what he was getting at, what he was speaking about, how he felt. I'll sort of read through that. And when I read through things like that, I generally read out loud. If you're looking at something that has to be spoken out loud, it's better that you speak it out loud than do it in your head.
Mm.
Because then you can hear it off the page. Yeah, because things are a lot different when you sort of internalize it than when you actually take it off the page vocally, the audio. So then I'd record myself saying it visually, because this was a visual one as well as an audio one, and I just work in it. So I could see it back after I'd done a few takes and think, right, I need to change that. It's not conveying how I want it to convey. So then, you know, once I've done that a few times and I'm happy with how it sounds and how it comes across, That's how I worked at that anyway. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if I was going to do something where it has to, I had to actually learn it as well. It would, you know, I'd be learning things two or three lines at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, going over it and then adding on a couple lines. You know.
Mm.
And then, you know, it just slowly sinks in, especially with Shakespeare. Sometimes some people find it very hard to memorize Shakespeare. But Shakespeare is a good language, a good sort of style to learn, because Shakespeare's done a lot of the work for you in the way he's written it, with a pentameter, etc.
Absolutely, the rhythm. And if you, obviously, for this one, you just did it vocally for me, but on your Instagram, there's a video of this one. And what would you do? Obviously, you were confined because you were doing it on screen. But what would you think about with regards to movement or maybe facial expression if this is something you were doing on the stage?
Right. So, again, right on stage, this character, you know, Caliban, is a tortured person. You know, tortured mind, tortured soul. Being tortured by other people, yeah. Mm. So he's not a particularly healthy person, yeah. So he's probably got some aches and pains, and he's from being bullied and hit and hiding out. So he's tortured in his mind. He's tortured in his body. So you know, when he's speaking. I don't think he smiles much. Everything is tortured about him, so that, you know, when he's speaking, and well, you know, I think even though his spirits are around, you know, I'm still gonna say this, but so he internalizes a lot of his thoughts, although they're audio, you know, they're verbal, so that you can hear them. Mm. A lot of it is an internal. It's like an aside. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's racked. It's racked with torment, as you say it. So he's not a guy that will be standing up straight. He'll have a hunch. Yeah. So if you can imagine him standing on the stage, he'll have a bit of a hunch. You know, maybe. Some of it, you know, his hand, you know, he's had an injury before, it'd be curled, and he'll be, you know, at the front of the stage, looking out into the audience. It'd be very personal when he's out there, and the audience are there. You know, some of the audience may cringe, because they actually think that he's talking to them, you know?
Mm. Brilliant.
And obviously, even though he's tortured, you're still going to make him articulate so that you can understand the words. No good going into this. Well, you know, so you can't understand what he's saying. You still don't understand what he's saying.
Absolutely.
But articulate and you know, just enjoy Shakespeare's writing and his words.
Brilliant.
As you say it.
Mm, that's fantastic. And obviously, in this particular speech, he's talking out to the audience. But if he were interacting with Prospero, how do you think he would physicalize that?
Well, again, I mean, Prospero frightens him. So, I mean, I think he'd sort of be in a slightly cowering position. You know, as Prospero is. Making, you know, speaking to him and speaking down at him, you know, he'll be cowering and in a defensive mode.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Thank you so much. I think that's going to be so helpful to students everywhere that are studying The Tempest at this time for their exams. It's really lovely to actually hear the words of an actor interpreting the questions that the exam board set, as opposed, you know, it's really nice to get that perspective for the students, and really lovely to hear about Pretty Woman and that role, James Morse. And I look forward to checking in, maybe not every day, but for your sonnets every other day. and good luck and safekeeping with everything that's going on at the moment.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you asking me to do this, the monologue and the interview. You know, I mean, it's I love to give back. You know, so giving back in this way to you and your students is a wonderful way, especially in these times.
So you can listen to the rest of our interview in episode 21 of Theatre Audience Podcast. So Caliban, fearing that Trinculo is one of Prospero's spirits, hides himself under a cloak. Trinculo is fearful of the weather. He discovers Caliban and thinks of using him to make his fortune in England. Hearing thunder, Trinculo creeps under Caliban's cloak. So Trinculo is a jester, and like Stefano, he's greedy and dishonourable. He quickly joins in a plan to kill Prospero. He's witty and sarcastic, but he's also a bit of a coward. The Elizabethan and Jacobean exploration of the Americas is strongly echoed in The Tempest. Explorers sometimes brought inhabitants of the newly discovered countries back to England. These were often cruelly displayed for profit in fairgrounds and other public places, and the exhibitors made large profits from this inhuman practice. You'll see this in the line, "There would this monster make a man," means that Caliban would make him a large fortune. So here's the entrance of Trinculo.
Here's neither bush nor shrub to bear off any weather at all. Another storm brewing. I hear it sing in the wind. Yon same black cloud, yon huge one, looks like a foul bombard that would shed his liquor. If it should thunder as it did before, I know not where to hide my head. Yon same cloud cannot choose but fall by pailfuls. What have we here? A man or a fish? Dead or alive? A fish. Smells like a fish. A very ancient, a fish-like smell, a kind of not of the newest poor John. Strange fish. Were I in England now, as once I was, and had but this fish painted, not a holiday fool there but would give a piece of silver. There would this monster make a man. Any strange beast there makes a man. When they will not give a doit to relieve a lame beggar, they will lay out 10 to see a dead Indian. Legged like a man, and his fins like arms. Warm, on my troth. I do now let loose my opinion, hold it no longer. This is no fish, but an islander that hath lately suffered by a thunderbolt. Oh, alas, the storm is come again. My best way is to creep under his gabardine. There's no other shelter hereabout. Oh, misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows. I will here shroud till the dregs of the storm be past.
Thank you to Stephen Blake for his interpretation of Trinculo. So Stephen's a good friend of mine. We met at drama school, and he's an experienced theatre, television and film actor. His recent work includes Emmerdale, Doctors, The Crown, Rome and Belgravia. Here's his commentary of how he created this speech.
So, preparation. You would do a physical and vocal warm-up, do some stretching, just to make yourself feel relaxed and physically comfortable. You could do some breathing exercises on your hands and knees, counting from 1 to 10 and then backwards 10 to 1 to open up your diaphragm. Buzzing from your head down to your stomach to get from the whole range from high to low to open up all the different channels in your head. You could do some humming in your head. You massage your face to make sure the facial muscles are relaxed. Exercise the mouth, lips and tongue. Do tongue twisters to make sure you can get your, you know, you can say all those difficult words in the text. Also practice lines on stage, preferably. This could be either very quietly to different areas in the audience to make sure that all those different areas can hear what you're saying and it's clear, even at quiet levels. You can speed run your lines to yourself and also do a loud ha to different areas just to make sure that you've got the range and everyone can hear you at different levels. As regards motivation, I mean, usually you would have a super objective, which is basically what, you know, you set out in the morning what you want to do for the rest of your day. And that super objective would be replaced by mini objectives. So every obstacle that comes your way, you would then, you know, so he's, Trinculo's thinking about needing to shelter. He sees Caliban and then hides under the cloak, essentially, in that first opening speech, in his first entrance. There are usually clues in the text, but there are none here in The Tempest. And Shakespeare doesn't generally give stage directions as such. Trinculo is written in prose, which kind of frees the actor up. Prose is usually reserved for so-called lower status characters and comic characters, whereas higher status characters would be speaking in verse and therefore would use the iambic pentameter, which give you all kinds of clues as to your breathing, and the breathing feeds into what you might be feeling or thinking. Questions to ask yourself before your character comes on stage. What has he been doing? What has he or she been doing before coming on? Was Trinculo drinking before? Was it a party? Where's he going now? And all these decisions that you make, these clear decisions you make, will have affect the mood and behaviour and essentially the energy of the character as he comes on stage. And usually speaking, as a rule, for the first entrance, it's best to make a positive decision so it's a good positive energy for coming on stage.
So to wrap up Act 2, Scene 2, Stefano and Trinculo were on the ship together. They both assumed the other had drowned in the storm and don't recognise each other at first. Stefano thinks he's found a monster. Stefano's the butler from the ship. He arrives singing drunkenly. He comes across Caliban and thinks he's some kind of sick monster. Stefano gives Caliban some wine to try and make him better. Then Trinculo speaks up from under Caliban's cloak and Stefano thinks the monster has two heads. Eventually, Trinculo reveals himself and they tell each other how they escaped from the shipwreck. Stefano gives Trinculo some wine, telling him he's got a stash of it. Caliban thinks Stefano is a god because Stefano's drink has healed him, and Caliban thinks Stefano is a god and offers to worship him and show him round the island. Stefano thinks this is funny and goes along with it, and Caliban leads Stefano and Trinculo off, singing drunkenly. And in the next episode of Theatre Audience Podcast, we will pick up in Act 3, where Ferdinand and Miranda are in love. Tempest Top Tips. So it's important that I credit and direct students to the following publications. I've used Shakespeare for Beginners by Brandon Toropov and the Cambridge School Shakespeare, York Notes on the Tempest and the Arden Shakespeare. All of these publications have particularly good notes on the Tempest. Also for revision and also for younger audiences, there's the BBC Shakespeare animated tales The Tempest and also Upstart Crow. So this was the TV comedy series created by Ben Elton and starring David Mitchell as Shakespeare. If you listen to my response to the first night preview of Upstart Crow, you can find this on episode 16 of Theatre Audience Podcast. Important historic productions of The Tempest include the 1988 National Theatre production. This was directed by Peter Hall and Prospero was played by Michael Bryant. And in 1993, the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford-upon-Avon had a production which was very noted, and this was directed by Sam Mendes and Prospero was played by Alex McCowan. If you go onto Digital Theatre Plus, you can see more recent productions. So 3 years ago, I saw the Royal Shakespeare Company's production, which was on at the Barbican, and this had my friend Johnny Broadbent in the show, and I'll be talking about him in my finale and curtain call. The BBC Studios, The Tempest production is also on Digital Theatre, and Phyllida Lloyd's all-female version of The Tempest is at the Donmar Warehouse. This is also on Digital Theatre, and this was starring Harriet Walter. And now for my finale and curtain call. A huge thank you to all the actors who have taken part in my project. In this episode, Jess Kambitsis, Tom Dickerson, Mark Holden and Stephen Blake. And coming up in the next episode, Ewan Wilson, Francis Knox, Julian Blundell, Lydia Barton-Lovett, Bella Humphreys and Rufus Wright, who I interviewed in episode 6 backstage at the Olivier at the National Theatre on Translations, and Johnny Broadbent, who I interviewed in episode 9 backstage at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse at the Globe Theatre when he was playing the title role of Henry VI. I'd like to dedicate Trapped Teaching Tempest in Quarantine to the following 5 inspirational educators. To the late Louise Bibbins, my English teacher at secondary school, who installed an understanding and unquenching thirst for the love of Shakespeare's language and imagery. To the late Jacqueline Nichols, who created the Dulwich Youth Theatre and First Rung Theatre Company, and who inspired a generation of young actors, directors, drama teachers and designers, taking us on a journey with Shakespeare from the page to the stage. To Carol Rutter, the Professor of Shakespeare and Performance Studies at Warwick University, and to the late Edward Wilson, who directed me in Othello at the National Youth Theatre, and Patrick Tucker for his Q Script workshops at Drama School with the original Shakespeare Theatre Company. Please tune in next time and recommend us to all your friends and family. Follow us on Spotify, Facebook and Instagram at Theatre Audience Podcast and on Twitter at Theatre Audie Pod. And do send us any recommendations of things you think we should see and review. If you've enjoyed the show, then please subscribe and rate us on iTunes and leave us a little review. Until next time, goodbye and thank you for listening.